Hey, this is Mark Stein. This Saturday, I'll be celebrating Charles Aznavour and songs from New Zealand, plus Sinatra live around the world, supernatural cows, and Bing Crosby's producer talks to me about Bing's very last album. On the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. May 15th, 2024. It is 3 p.m. in Asunción, where they are celebrating Paraguay's Independence Day. 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes. 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland. And beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. British summertime. 9 p.m. in Rome. 10 p.m. in Jerusalem. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran. For all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone, midnight 45 in Kathmandu. For all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone, 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers. I'm so sorry about that. 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne. Still kind of a little bit sorry. 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a far more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeri in his Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Still having voice problems, but I'll endeavour to stagger through to the end of the hour. Last week was the 7th birthday of the Mark Stein Club, and I thank all those who were with us on that very first day, May the 6th, 2017, who decided that they simply had to re-up for our 8th year. And I hope that our first fortnight founding members will want to do the same as the week proceeds. Thank you also to those of you who've signed up a chum for a Mark Stein Club gift membership. I certainly hope they're still speaking to you. 850 years ago today, May the 15th, 1174, Nur al-Din Zengi died. He was the Emir of Aleppo, a very effective commander in the Second Crusade and ruler of the Syrian province of the Great Seljuk Empire. If you've never heard of the Great Seljuk Empire, don't worry about it. That's what they'll be saying about us soon enough. But at its height, it stretched all the way from what's now it's the Stan without any vowels. It's the vowel-free Stan. Kyrgyzstan. It stretched all the way from Kyrgyzstan on the Chinese border all the way to, oh, look, Gaza. Dead 850 years ago today, Nur al-Din Zengi, Emir of Aleppo. As we speak at this hour, the Prime Minister of Slovakia, Robert Fico, is in hospital with what are reported as life-threatening injuries. He was shot multiple times in the chest and stomach. He took at least 5 shots, I believe, by a 71-year-old would-be assassin who, it is said, is the author of 3 volumes of poetry and the founder of the Movement Against Violence. Mr. Fico is Slovakia's longest-serving prime minister. He's been in and out of office since the beginning of the century. He is a populist, so-called. The BBC's man on the scene says basically Mr. Fico brought it on himself. He drove the founder of the Movement Against Violence to shoot him. Political violence is not common in this country. You have to go back over a century to the assassination of the finance minister of what was then Czechoslovakia. That was 1923, Tommy and Tuppence time. just to put our current tale for our time in context. What else is happening? Well, as you know, on June the 11th, I'm going to be in the English High Court, the Royal Courts of Justice in London, taking Ofcom to court for ruling against me in my coverage of the COVID vaccines. Because oddly enough, I dissented from the prevailing orthodoxy from all those telly doctors you see on the morning shows sitting on the sofas and telling you how spiffy all these new vaccines are. And I wasn't saying stuff like that. People wonder why. Well, why weren't you promoting AstraZeneca and saying what a bang-up job those guys were doing? Well, it turns out because I wasn't on the take from AstraZeneca. TV doctors, including Ranj Singh, Nigat Arif and Philippa Kay, all received thousands of pounds in so-called contracted service fees from AstraZeneca. All of them were vocal in their support for AstraZeneca and the other COVID-19 vaccines, which I believe actually is against the law. So never mind Ofcom, it's actually a breach of real law too, for them to be promoting products whose company is paying them very lavishly. But you can bet your bottom dollar that Dame Melanie Dawes and Lord Grade, a third-rate light entertainment chief executive and actually the world's worst telly interviewer. Look at his interview. Google it. Look at his interview. I think it was at the Royal Festival Hall or the Queen Elizabeth Hall. His interview with my pal Don Black. He can't interview for Toffee. Anyway, I'm getting a bit distracted here. Never mind that he can't interview for Toffee. This is a corrupt organisation. How come you haven't got a word? It turns out it's not just that they say, oh, and this is 100% safe and effective, and you are 100% protected against getting the COVID or going to hospital or die. It's not just, I thought they were just, I'm so naive. I thought they were just doing that because either they were true believers or because, like that free-thinking guy who doesn't like anybody thinking anything different. What's he called? I can't remember his name now. Dr. Matthew Sweet. I thought that these guys were just doing it either because they were true believers or because, you know, they don't want anybody contradicting the narrative. But no, it's more basic than that. They're on the take from AstraZeneca. Are there going to be criminal prosecutions or even a mild rap on the knuckles from Ofcom? What else is going on? Oh, headline of the day. This is from Iran. Urinals or urinals, whatever you take your pick. I don't think it makes any difference to how you use them. Urinals removed from Tehran shopping malls for being un-Islamic. We've got a whole subplot on that in my Laugh a Minute caper, The Prisoner of Windsor. So that's another... That's another small thing where we were ahead of the game. Let's get to your questions. Todd Hines says, hi, Mark. As an admitted procrastinator and thus a mere first month founding member of the Mark Stein Club, I look forward to re-upping. So wait a minute. How did this guy, he wasn't a first day founding member, he wasn't a first weekend founding member, he wasn't a first week founding member, he wasn't a first fortnight founding member, he waited till the tail end of the first month to, how did this guy get to be in the questions? He's dead to me. Someone needs to answer for this. I don't understand how he managed to slip through the net, honestly. Procrastinator. Todd Hines goes on. In last week's Q&A, you revisited the protracted and uniquely peaceful transfer of power that follows an American presidential election. Yeah, I love that. You know, the Wednesday morning, they're always, oh, and this is something that's unique to America, the peaceful transfer of power. They don't have that in places like Canada. The king has to be taken out by the handles before there's a transfer of power. But you have this unique, peaceful transfer of power that nobody else in the world has. I love the way all these people start talking about it. And that's the code. I think it may even be the CIA official password. Operation Peaceful Transfer of Power swings into action on the Wednesday morning unlikely event that the Republican wins the election, and they have 2.5 months to subvert the will of the people and clobber and hobble the incoming administration. And they did it spectacularly. I'm told that the whole thing, it used to be from November to March, and that was apparently the time it took to go by horseback from whatever the most remote state capital was. So your electors needed time to get on horseback. But I believe even with TSA security now, they managed to cut down the time it takes to get from the most remote state to Washington. But you still have this unique peaceful transfer power because it offers, it's just fantastic because it means that the permanent state, the deep state, whatever you want to call them, as I said, they can work with the Democrats, and they've got 2.5 months to get up to mischief. Todd goes on, I expect whatever the outcome, this coming November through January will be anything but tranquil. It seems to me that either way, unrest is in the cards. Yeah, I don't think whatever happened. The question is, I mean, do we need to get to that stage? The question is Trump going to be allowed to win? On the face of it, the polls don't look good for Biden. But on the other hand, given how lousy he is, the polls, in a certain sense, don't. I mean, they're worse than they were in 2016 and 2020. Hillary was ahead all through 2016. Well, certainly at this point, Hillary was ahead in 2016 and Biden was ahead in 2020. If you think these polls are real, now the polls are showing Trump's ahead. The question is whether he'll be allowed to win. If some of these numbers in the swing states are correct, they're going to have a huge voter fraud operation. I mean, it's not just going to be a few thousand votes here and there. They're going to need fleets of vans to deliver all these extra ballots. If you're, trying to get a U-Haul in the days before that election, forget about it. They're all going to be out to the Democrat Party. Anyway, let's say that Trump does win. What is that period going to be like? This ludicrous period. And again, I don't want to have to keep saying this, but don't wave that Constitution at me, because everybody else seems to be able to get the guy who's been rejected by the voters out of the place in a few days. There's exceptions like the present imbroglio in the Netherlands, where it's 6 months since the election, but they can't figure out a way to form a government, although Geert Wilders says they've apparently reached agreement. But everywhere else, whatever it is in the UK, the election's on Thursday, and if you lose, you're out by the weekend. Because that's how it should be. This whole thing, and again, don't tell me about, don't wave the Constitution. I don't want to start doing the Constitution waving thing this early in the show, but it's not a good idea. You saw what happened. Like, they destroyed Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn's promoting something at the moment. I'm not sure what it is. Is it a film or a book or something? But he talks about how he was thinking of he's financially ruined by them deciding to get him. and he was contemplating suicide. That's your peace, uniquely peaceful transfer of power. There's no need for it. And the Democrats use it to screw you over. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're all saying, no, the founders knew what they were doing in calculating how long it takes to ride a horse from Augusta, Maine, or wherever it was at that time, the furthest state. They knew what they were doing. No. The thing about it now is Trump has been brilliant, actually, in a way that he wasn't in 2020. In 2016, he was brilliant in an improvisatory sense. He was just sort of riffing his way to the presidency. But the fact of the matter is, starting on the Wednesday morning, he's going to have to be fantastically alert for all the sabotage. And I don't, the question is, even if he manages somehow to win, which he wasn't supposed to do in 2016, the question then is, they've got 2.5 months to figure out how to prevent him from taking office. And the thing about it is, they're going to do that. You know they're going to do that because of all this these lawsuits. They want him in jail and they want him to die in jail. And so if they're frustrated, they're only going to be... That story out of Slovakia. There is a lot of political... there is a lot of political violence in our futures in the Western world. Going to be a whole lot of it. Scott Scherzer writes from Miami Beach. Scott says, "Dear Mark, I would argue that the lawfare being practiced against Trump has been the best thing that could have happened to him. It requires him to be mum for most of the day and provides the perfect stage after hours for him to do his shtick and decry the cesspool that is our criminal justice system. Then once the weekend arrives, he gets to put on a show for 100,000 rabid fans in a decidedly blue state. Do you think that the Democrat Party would have still moved forward with all of these ridiculous lawsuits if they knew that this would be the result? Happy to see that I had enough juice on my credit card to renew my membership for an 8th year. Please take good care of yourself, as your voice is indispensable." Actually, my voice is packing up. Just let me take a sip of water here. Indispensable, but inoperative. I think it is. He's making the best of a bad job. But the idea that you would be... He's looking at 136 years in jail, I think, if he were to lose all these cases. And when you get an evil hack, like the two judges in New York, they'd be happy to send him to the slammer for the full 136. Or, 136 years with the possibility of parole after 127 years. It takes a lot. I mean, I'm just in a couple of rinky-dink cases, and it's exhausting and it's demoralizing. You wake up to it every morning. Half the rubbish in your inbox is from lawyers filing motions about things you can barely keep on top of. And that's why I think what Trump has done whatever it was the other day, where he's actually taking a posse into court with him. So he's taking the Speaker of the House and these other big shots. And then he comes out and he basically is doing like a mini State of the Union, standing outside the courthouse, where the judge is planning to send him to jail for 136 years. I think that's brilliant. But when you say, you suggest, Scott, that the Democrats might be regretting what they're doing to him, I don't think so at all. I think they'd do it all over again because their base, don't forget, we're going back now to 2016 and the Russia investigation. And most of the people who vote for Joe Biden don't know that the Russia investigation was a crock. They don't know that the Hunter Biden laptop is real. They don't know that the 57 intelligence agency heads who said it was Russian disinformation, they don't know that they were just put up to that by a Biden hack, by Blinken, I think it was. They don't know any of that. I mean, this is how you get to the situation in Slovakia, where a nation becomes like the overlaid zip codes they have now. So you think, oh, yeah, New York, that's the 212, not zip codes, area codes. New York, that's the 212 area code. But no, wait, no, they ran out of 212 numbers, so they've got this extra area code that's laid over the same thing. And that's what America is, actually, at the moment. It's not, you know, as neat as blue state and red state. Basically, you have huge commingled populations living in alternative universes. And the Democrats, there are a lot of the Democrat base thinks Trump is a criminal and that he's committed crimes. And if you ask them, well, what crimes has he actually committed? This thing that's going on in New York, do you know what that is? The one where they fined him $500 million? Do you know what that was about? They couldn't tell you what it was about, but they know he's a criminal. And they vote for candidates like the awful Attorney General, Letitia James, who actually should be in jail herself. She's abusing the law to go after people like VDare for no crime. She just demands they cough up, you know, 20 years of documents, even though there's no crime, they haven't been charged with anything. She's not even told them what she's thinking of charging them with. She should be in jail. She should. But America is a land of men, not of laws. And so that means that the laws are only applied to Trump and to VDare. And then if you're somebody else, the law does not apply to you. But the fact is that she was elected on a promise to get Trump, which is what the Democrats want. So the Democrats like this circus because they think of it as getting Trump. They don't understand that it's solidified his base. Who knows? If they hadn't done this to Trump, you might be looking at Republican nominee Nikki Haley or whoever right now, Chris Christie. But they did this to Trump and he ran away. There wasn't a primary this year. The whole primary thing was a complete waste of time because he'd won it. He'd wrapped the whole thing up basically through all these lawsuits, you know, 6 months before Iowa and New Hampshire. So the Democrat base would be incredibly depressed if suddenly, you know, Merrick Garland were to say, well, I view with grave concern these clearly politically motivated lawsuits against the candidate of one of our two great parties. They don't want that at all. And that's the thing. They have, it is related to what's happened today in Slovakia, is that it's easy to whip people up, not so hard as I think it was the Slovak defense minister said a couple of hours ago, then to calm people down. And we do not know what is going to happen between November and January. But would the Democrats do it all over again? Yes, because delegitimizing the opposition has been their standard playbook for the entirety of this century so far, and we're now a quarter of the way through it. The notorious Mr. J says, best wishes for your improving health. Who told you it was improving? What actually was that with the University of Vermont Medical Center anyway? Well, actually, they denied me a blood transfusion on, I think, political grounds. My cardiologist in Montreal was absolutely astonished by that. And I wound up having to I was in emergency. I couldn't walk. I was in a wheelchair. My numbers, whatever had gone down to, it had gone down below 7. When it gets to 6, you die or whatever it was. But they'd agreed to give me the blood transfusion, and I was being prepped for it. And then an administrator came down, not a doctor, not a nurse, an administrator came down. Even though I've got a so-called Cadillac Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, she said she wasn't going to give me a blood transfusion. So I had to scramble and get up to the Royal Victoria in Montreal. I don't know what you do. If that happens to you and you're not, 20 minutes south of an international frontier and can go to another country, I don't know what you're meant to do. The notorious Mr. J then continues a question, an important one about the coming clown show that will be the 2024 presidential election. How crazy could it get? If Trump simultaneously wins the election and gets a felony conviction, what will go down? Will he run the White House like a mafia don running the rackets from the slammer? Surely, under these circumstances, he would be a ripe target for a successful impeachment effort. Will America be subjected to the surreal spectacle of a presidential auto-pardon? The weirdness would not abate if Biden wins. In that case, we would be treated to the sad spectacle of a chief executive being hustled out due to decay and infirmity with a mediocrity incarnate taking the job over. Pathetic any way you cut it. Well, I don't think they'd be bothered by that. I think they're quite happy with Biden. It doesn't matter if he's dead. Doesn't matter if Kamala is even more brain dead than he is, and she's only half his age. No, none of that matters. It's they're getting you used to. I said, and I think I suggested to Tucker, it was just a sort of throwaway thing at one point when he asked. I said maybe Biden's just going to be like a constitutional monarch, and there'll be other people who are actually running the thing. And this was months before the election. And Tucker actually did an impression of the Queen with her gloved hand and that very distinctive wave she does as her coach passes her subjects in the street. But it actually is worse than that, because you're getting someone who is supposed to be running the government, and they're clearly not. He's prepped and wheeled out, and his little 30-second promo taunting Trump and saying, let's see if you're man enough to debate me. I hear you're free on Wednesdays. They give him the pills, they prep him. I don't know, I would imagine they have to do 157 takes to get anything usable. But that suits them fine. And they're getting you used to the idea. As I said, we are moving into, it is a new, the period of self-government by the people is very short. It's not normal. And we had it, and it worked well for a bit, and then it didn't work so well. And then it degenerated into mere dinner theatre. So that, as in the UK, you've had both Penny Mordaunt and her opposite number on the Labour benches announcing all the things, agreeing on all the things you're not meant to talk about in elections. Okay, then. So in that case, what is the choice? What are we choosing? If we can't talk about anything that matters, what is the election? And the election is, it's just like a sport for people who want to dispense with the graceful and elegant part of it, which is the thrill of sporting competition on the field. And instead, it's just a horse race where the horses are just tired old nags who can't do anything. But it is... I don't think that they would mind. They don't care how decrepit Biden. It's very much like the old Soviet playbook, because the where you remember the May Day parades in Moscow, everyone was surprised because there were rumors that Andropov or Brezhnev or Chernenko had been dead for 2 weeks. But then there would be the May Day parade, and they'd prop the guys all up. They'd all be propped up there on the Kremlin balcony with the giant unibrow going from left to right. And yes, they didn't move much. And yes, towards the end of the parade, one of them looked as if he was toppling, you know, to one side and leaning at a rather alarming angle. But it didn't matter. The fact of the matter is, at a certain point, the machine can keep these things going. And it's useful to actually teach people that it doesn't matter, that the guy who's called Mr. President or whatever actually doesn't matter. As for Trump's thing, he won't be able to pardon himself from, you know, the New York business because they're state cases. He can only pardon himself in federal cases. This is, again, something they've thought about just in case. But the fact, you just consider what you've been saying here. Oh, he'd be ripe for, there'd be a successful impeachment effort. Well, that would have to, even if it was to be a fabulous night for the Democrats in the Senate, you would still need significant numbers of Republican senators to agree to essentially override the voice of the people. And once you do that, then it's all over. You know, if you can have, it's one thing for the guy, oh yeah, Trump got into office and we're gonna impeach him for something. You'd be basically impeaching him for winning the election. And I don't rule anything out, because I think America is going down the toilet of history extremely fast. We were talking about norms at Stein Online a couple of days ago. And I was saying we're now in a world without norms. Well, the Democrats and the media and the go-along to get-along Republicans have destroyed almost all political norms. Not just American norms, although specifically American norms have been destroyed, but the general norms that govern free societies. The point about elections is it's a way of ensuring that the loser doesn't shoot up the joint, because the loser in the contest for power understands that it's been a fair contest and that he'll be able to have another fair go in 2, 4, 5 years' time or whatever. America has inflicted since all that, you know, Operation Crossfire Hurricane stuff has inflicted huge damage on that. And no prudent politician would do that. But these guys, the bloodlust is in their nostrils, and they would like to kill him, I think. You know, you forget, everyone thinks, people think, you know, oh, Putin, yes, okay, he talks a good game about nationalism and wokery and this and that, but on the other hand, he does, you know, he has his enemies thrown out of windows. You don't think that the deep state, you know, we have all this stuff, you find it out 50 years later, certain agencies were connected to the Kennedy assassination or whatever. You don't think these people, you know, we're talking about people who aren't shy about droning Afghan moppets on their way out the door, you know, big guys like Thoroughly Modern Millie. You don't think that if this election goes away, they don't like that, they wouldn't actually start thinking about harder crackdown. Look at the number of, they don't care about any of these January 6th people. The first January 6th guy driven to suicide, you would think that Democrats and the media would say, oh yeah, you know, maybe we're getting carried away. I mean, she was just some grandmother with no criminal record, and she's been in solitary for 2 years. You know, don't you think that it's very deluded to assume that these people are squeamish about political violence, what they've done with the January 6th guys is really political violence. It is. And there are, you know, there should be enough dead bodies to weigh on people's consciences if they had consciences. Let's pause from that glum thought for a bit of music. As you may know, last Saturday I launched a new weekly show on Serenade Radio. That's 5 p.m. London time every Saturday, which is 12 midday North American Eastern. Mark Stein on the town, an hour of music tied to significant anniversaries and the dear departed and whatnot, which we used to do right here on Q&A. But we're moving it to its own dedicated show because of all the complaints we had from people who said, why are you talking about Sarah Vaughan rather than Chris Christie? So now we'll be free to talk about Chris Christie nonstop, even Nikki Haley. And that's a thrill, isn't it? But still in all, it is Independence Day in Paraguay. So how about something Paraguayan to give my voice a rest for a couple of minutes? I can't claim to be an expert in Paraguayan music, so I hope our Paraguayan listeners will forgive me. This is how inexpert I am. I was first struck by the Paraguayan composer Agustin Barrios because he looked like Hercule Poirot on the album cover, so he fits with the general Agatha Christie vibe we've got going on in these parts. But after I got over that, I thought, oh yeah, the music's not bad either. This is one of my favourite guitarists, that great son of Melbourne, Victoria, John Williams, from his album released with the title From the Jungles of Paraguay, which makes him sound like some sort of drug mule. But it's an absolutely lovely CD. John Williams plays Agustin Barrios. John Williams with music from Paraguay on this Paraguayan Independence Day, Agustin Barrios's Air December, which always sounds a little bit to me as if it's trying to break into the theme from The Godfather. But Señor Barrios wrote his first. More music on Saturday. Mark Stein on the town, 5 p.m. London time on Serenade Radio. While we're plugging, I know that some listeners at least want me to mention Anne McElhinney and Phelan McAleer's brand new play, which has just opened in New York, about October the 7th in Israel. And you know how Anne and Phelan work. They get, as they did with my trial, they just use the actual transcripts. And all they do, I shouldn't say all they do, actually, because they do it brilliantly, is they arrange them into their most effective dramatic presentation. So it's not just sitting in some awful courtroom like the District of Columbia Superior Court. In this case, they went off to Israel and they talked to people who were involved. I shouldn't say involved, really. That's not the right word. They were sort of hippie peaceniks who were just attending that music festival. And suddenly, in the midst of all the prancing unicorn delusions, reality descends from the skies or rides in a pickup truck, and their world changes. And they just interviewed all these people, and then they took the interviews. They spoke to people of all ages and ethnicities and circumstances, and the only words you hear on the stage are the actual words spoken by the people who were there on the ground on October the 7th. And there's a lot of tragedy, there's a lot of resilience, there's a bit of hope, and there's even a little bit of humour. And I've heard very good things from the people who've seen the first couple of performances. I believe it's actually official. They've had their official first night now. But it's running until June the 16th at the Actors Temple Theatre, which is on West 47th Street in New York City. So it's off Broadway. I don't have a URL? I don't have a website to tell you where to go for tickets. Something of a basic oversight on the part of one of my associates, but I will try and make sure that we put the website for you to go for tickets to that, because you should see this. I would be there if I don't find travel rather disturbing at the moment, and I didn't have to save up my strength to be in court in June. But I hope to see it along the way somewhere later in its run, if it comes to Boston or Manchester, New Hampshire, or whatever. But you should certainly see it before the New York run ends. It's running till June the 16th. And Phelim, I was given a line reading by Phelim when Michelle Buckman and I did one of his plays about Peter Strzok and his paramour. And it's an awful long time since any director ever gave me a line reading, but he was quite right about that. And I hope he's doing the same with the actors he's got in this play running at the Actors Temple Theatre on 47th Street in New York, just off Broadway. It is 17 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That's 17 to 9 British Summertime. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Mark Stein live around the planet. And we're going to get back to some of your questions now, because there's a lot going on in the world and we're trying to make sense of it, which isn't always easy to do. Let's see, what should we do? Chris Davis says, Mark, 2 years on from tackling the World Health Organization pandemic treaty on the Mark Stein Show, is it any surprise to see your old warm-up act at GB News, Nigel Farage, jumping on the bandwagon to oppose it? He's never been right too soon, as you've said many times before, but even by his standards, it is a little late in the day to be soiling his hands now. Nigel has, I've said this before, that he's had brilliant political timing with things like forming the Brexit Party a month before the European elections. You couldn't even do it in America. You have to have gotten on the ballot, whatever it is, 6 months before the election day. So he's very good with things like that. But he made one basic mistake through the 30 years he was fighting for Brexit, which is sincere. He wanted Britain out of the European Union, and he achieved that nominally. And then his great victory was hollowed out and undermined from within by people who, as with the American deep state, did not wish to accept the people's verdict. And Nigel's basic mistake was thinking that he was a natural Tory and that at some point he would come home to the, when the Tory party realized it had lost the Brexit vote, that he would come home to the Tories and the Tories could be reformed. And that isn't true. He's now talking about, you know, the Conservative Party needing to be destroyed. And it's a shame he didn't realize that earlier. The fact of the matter is, you have to... He understood, because he and I talked over several years about the Canadian election result from 30 years ago, in which the Canadian Conservative Party was reduced to 2 seats. A new party rose up in the West and eventually effected a reverse takeover of the Tories that drove the so-called Red Tories, who were the left-wing progressive Tories, more or less out of the movement. And what Nigel failed to realise, and this was crucial in 2019, because in 2019 they had a charismatic leader in Boris. Even if you loathe Boris, you have to admit that he, when he's blustering about doing his Woodhousian shtick, a very odd thing to do for a Turk or whatever he is, but when he's doing it, he connects with people. Rishi Sunak can't connect with his own underpants. He's a man who, even if you are into the whole deep state thing of undermining the will of the people and making sure that your man gets in there instead, you've got to make sure you've got a guy who can... He's just lousy at everything. Did you see him at Prime Minister's Questions today? Starmer kicked his butt. It was pathetic. So what happened in 2019 was that they were in a bad position, and Boris ran on the thing of get Brexit done after Theresa May had just been seen to be, you know, basically got rolled by Michel Barnier and the Europeans, what I mean is that even recognizing that she wanted to just have a soft Brexit, once he got that impression, Michel Barnier just rammed it all down her gullet. So, and it all completely cynical, so that the same Irish twits in Dublin who were, oh, no, yeah, we can't, if we don't want a border with Northern Ireland. Well, there's not going to be any border. There's never been, you know, a common travel area has existed since the Irish Free State seceded in 1922. So you don't have to worry. That's nothing to do with you. Oh, no, but it'd be undermining the Northern Ireland, the Good Friday Agreement, all the rest of it. And now the Windsor framework, because the High Court in Belfast has just ruled that the Rwandan scheme does not apply to Northern Ireland because it's incompatible with this so-called Windsor framework that Rishi and the King signed with Cruella von der Leyen from the European Union. So Nigel, by standing down all his candidates on the eve of the 2019 election allowed, I think, the greatest act of betrayal in since the 1832 Reform Act, in which people said, oh yeah, we're voting to get Brexit done. We want to get Brexit done. We're sick of this stalemate. Boris, Boris, go Boris, get Brexit done. Although they vote for him, they deliver whatever it was, the 80-seat majority, and then the Tories betray them because Nigel sat on his ass and allowed all the non-conservative candidates of the Conservative Party to get into the House of Commons and subvert Brexit. So Nigel, who has had moments of strategic genius, blew it there. And as I said, all this sort of he didn't say, she didn't say yes, she didn't say no routine that he's doing at the moment. The thing about it is, the Tory party, if Rees-Mogadon proposed that there should be a grand alliance of the right between the Conservative Party and the Reform Party, all that would mean is that the Reform Party would be providing cover for the Tories, but basically the Tories betrayed their own voter base. So if you're dumb enough to vote for them after what they've done to you, Nigel calculates his own interests. Trump, I don't think Trump actually knows him that well. but for some reason, Trump is susceptible to him, and he wouldn't have to offer him a terribly grand job for Nigel to take that. The Windsor framework is the negation of Brexit. And at a certain level, Nigel must understand that. Pat Smith says, hi, Mark. Happy belated 7th birthday. That's not actually me. I wish it was. I would love to be back in short trousers running around. Good luck in your travails across the pond. I was wondering if you have any comments on the goings-on across the Irish Sea in the birthplace of your maternal grandmother. No, that's not quite right. My maternal grandmother was born in Belgium, but my paternal grandparents and my dear old dad and my aunt and uncle and all kinds of other people were all born in Ireland. It seems the Celtic Irish have finally woke up in a good wokey way and are finally demanding an end to unfettered immigration. There is even talk of implementing a hard border between the Republic and the North to keep the migrants from Britain, fearing deportation to Rwanda, if only, from ferrying to Belfast and strolling across the border. The world is upside down. The Republic wants a hard border and Rishi wants an open border. Any thoughts? The border, this is one of those complete... I was just saying, it's part of a common travel area and has been since the Irish Free State seceded in 1922. And that was always the plan. There was never any thought that you would need to show a passport if you were travelling from Dublin to Manchester or from Cork to London or whatever. There was never any... That's nothing to do with Europe, nothing to do with migration. And in fact, when they... If I'm right, they didn't formalise that until the 1950s when the government... In fact, it was Mr. De Valera's ministry, if I recall correctly, accepted that a requirement of that was that, in effect, the Irish authorities had to have exactly the same immigration policies as the authorities in London. So, British subjects were treated differently from some guy from Paraguay. to bring the Baraguayans back into the conversation. And the only reason it's a problem now, and they didn't mind doing that, even, you know, they could be quite the whole. I don't want to distress any of our Irish listeners, but I can see Anne McElhinney getting ready to hurl her foaming stein of beer at me over this. But, you know, essentially the Irish decided they wanted to be foreigners on the understanding that they wouldn't be treated as such, you know. Which is why they can vote in UK elections and all the rest of it. So all this talk about the border is rubbish. But what's the humbug is not on Rishi. Rishi is a duplicitous little toad who sold out his own country to Cruella von der Leyen. But the fact of the matter is that there's no need for, I'm very worried I'm going to be deported to Rwanda, so I'm going to hole up in Belfast and then sneak across the open border into the south. We've just heard the High Court in Belfast say that the Rwanda scheme doesn't apply to Northern Ireland. It doesn't actually apply. And if it is incompatible with European Union law, then by that logic, it is also incompatible with European Union law in Great Britain, which Rishi and the King and Cruella decided that the entirety of the United Kingdom was bound by. You know, politicians want you. The whole, what we're talking about now is a subplot of a subplot of a subplot of an irrelevant diversion, which is the tide of people who don't want to be deported to Rwanda supposedly swamping Ireland. And that's as I said, a tiny subplot of the story in which the High Court of Northern Ireland ruled that the Rwanda scheme didn't apply to Northern Ireland, which in itself is a subplot of the Windsor framework, which is in itself a subplot of the entire Rwanda scheme, where we're supposed to be excited at a time when 1,000 Albanians arrive on England's southern shore every night, that once every 3.5 years, Rishi will deport someone to Rwanda. The whole thing is that they put it there so that the issue in England is that all these people are arriving. They're placing huge strains on accommodation. They're requisitioning all these hotels. They're putting people up in these hotels. They're ruining these towns. You've got these sexual predators hanging around the schoolyard gates and all the rest of it. They're placing enormous strain, the migrant tide, on health and education, property market. If you're wondering why your 43-year-old kid won't move out of the house, it's because with an unceasing tie, you know, he and his bird would like to move into the one-room flat, but there's 17 Albanians sleeping in that one-room flat, and he can't match what they pay. You know, so Rwanda is a way that, which is really politics in this dinner theatre phase of democracy. You think, well, how do we, this is a problematic issue for us, so how do we reframe it? Oh, I know, it'll be all about us trying to get some judge to agree to our scheme to fly 3 people a year to Rwanda. It's all nonsense. There is a genuine immigrant problem in Dublin, but it is nothing to do in Ireland. But it's nothing to do with Rishi Sunak being hot for Rwanda. It's entirely to do with Dublin's own immigration policies. But again, they're thinking, oh, look, maybe we can use Rwanda to reframe the issue. So we're now having this And they can do it because people are stupid. And none of the media people will... The same government that did its best to utterly destroy Brexit because it said that to have a hard border on the Irish border would be an absolute abomination. The same people who said that for years on end are now demand... The same people who put phrases like the Irish backstop in the language are now demanding that there be a hard border. Well, which would be fantastic, because the way things are going at the moment, Sinn Féin are going to be in government in Belfast and Sinn Féin are going to be in government in Dublin, because they're the only party that operates in both the UK and in the Irish state. And so the Shinners in Belfast can put up a huge wall to protect the Shinners in Dublin. So the Southern Shinners and the Northern Shinners will be protected from each other. Kenneth says, I see there were some more anti-immigration protests in Ireland recently. Ireland is full. Yeah, we covered that. They've been doing the Ireland is full thing for well over a year now, maybe 2 years, because we've certainly done that on the Mark Steyn Show, and I haven't been fit for television for a long time now. It seems the Irish are not on board with the narrative, and the claims it's right-wing extremists appear absurd. There aren't really any right-wing extremists in Ireland. But the fact of the matter, they're dealing with the same thing. I couldn't get over that. The amount of people who've been let into Ireland this century by Irish policy, long before Rishi Sunak and his Rwanda thing came along, have transformed towns I've known all my life. I was talking, I think, on this show a few weeks back about Navan when I took... I was in Enniskillen, and which is in the north, as they say in the south. I was in Enniskillen and I had to catch a flight out of Dublin to fly to the continent a year or two back. And I hadn't been in Navan for a couple of years, which is sort of, you know, just on that road as you head there. And I thought, oh, it'd be really nice. I couldn't get over the number, because I had sort of happy childhood memories of Navan and all the rest of it. I couldn't get over the number of covered women on the street. Sad and pathetic. We're watching the deaths here. There's no point. People won't even remember this, like, little... So you have 800 years of English tyranny, so-called, and then you got this little blip of the glorious Irish state, a nation once again, and... And then, you know, instead of Protestants and Catholics, it's Sunni and Shia. The number of people they've admitted, and it's utterly alien. And I go back to that thing because that's, if you're not shocked by that councillor in Yorkshire going Allahu Akbar, that's nothing to do with England. There's nothing to assimilate to anymore. In fact, what's happening when you import people on that scale is that the natives assimilate with the incomers. Kenneth says, is there still time for Ireland? They seem to have learned from the rest of Europe. Will the powers that be put the hate speech to the fore again to beat down the populace? Yes, because they're all in on this. You look at this attempted assassination in Slovakia, and the BBC guy is reporting, well, you know, the guy was asking for it. It's like he's basically like some bird wandering down the street in a miniskirt. He'd gotten too close to Viktor Orban in Hungary. They're presenting any alternative to the uniparty consensus in Ireland, in most of Western Europe. And especially they're presenting any alternative to it as crypto-fascism. Oh, no wonder political assassinations are back when you've got fascists in power. That's the BBC. That's the not so subtle subtext of the BBC. Our friend Ava, in that speech, apparently 50 million have seen it. Although, although 50 million people have seen it. I think, I saw somewhere today that like over 8 million people have seen the tweet in which Dan Wootton's fan club named me the greatest Briton for my stand against Ofcom. And I think it's an honorary award. It's not a substantive one because they, for some reason, they don't regard Canadians as Britons. But I'm with that Chief Minister of Gibraltar who talks about the British nations around the world. I'm very old school on that. But anyway, Ava's thing got 50 million, this speech of hers, and it's important to pay attention to what she said on it. She said correctly that the European Union cannot be reformed. It has to be ended. And the only way it will be ended, it won't be by getting the UK out of it and then creeping halfway back in with the Northern Ireland Protocol and the Windsor Framework and all the other bollocks. It would actually need France or Germany to leave and leave properly, and for the European Union to be ended. That's the only way there's really going to be any change on that. Jeff Estes says, "Hi, Mark. There's seemingly little concern by most politicians over the gargantuan national debt. I've heard no plan to address the issue." You're a funny guy, Jeff. Pardon me. I've heard no plan to address the issue, and I'm not sure what could possibly be done. Would like to hear your thoughts on this topic. Thanks, says Jeff. Look, I've said for years, there was a period, and actually it was, you know, credit where it's due. Paul Ryan was in the forefront of this. I'm going back now to the time I wrote After America, which is 13 years ago, when the debt, I think, was 10 trillion. It's now over 35 trillion, right? And back then, you could get a few people like Paul Ryan to take it semi-seriously. He projected some numbers out to, you know, whatever it was, 2040 or something. And I said, why don't you have any numbers for 2050 or 2060? And he goes, well, if this trajectory keeps up, there's not going to be a 2050 or a 2060 because the whole thing will be imploded. Now no one talks about that. If you bring up the debt to Washington politicians, they couldn't be less interested because they get away with it. It's exhilarating. It's Icarus soaring up to the sun. This is fantastic. I thought I'd have been burned up when I was at 10 trillion feet, but I'm now at 35 trillion feet and I'm still not burned up. And at some point, the laws of gravity and the laws of economic gravity will assert themselves here. There was never much serious talk about doing, you know, other countries who don't get to denominate the debt in their own currency. That's the only reason that America can do this, because of the Bretton Woods Conference. So basically because, you know, the US dollar became the world currency. Otherwise, without that, you're Zimbabwe. And I used to talk about this. I used to say, point out that in order to prevent any disturbances to their right, the Canadian Liberal Party in the 1990s, the Canadian Liberal Party, that's Justin Trudeau's party, paid down the federal debt. And Kate O'Byrne from National Review, when I pointed this out once somewhere on some panel or something, had a funny line. She said, oh, if only we could get American conservatives to be as fiscally responsible as Canadian liberals. And the New Zealand government at one point paid off, I think, almost all its crown debt, as they call it in His Majesty's Dominions, all that crown debt a few years ago. And I remember making that. Kate wasn't on the panel at that point, but Charles Krauthammer was. And Charles did that thing, oh, you know, New Zealand, that's not a real nation. I mean, of course, it's easy to pay off all your government debt if you don't have to be responsible for policing the planet, as America does. Well, you know, my view on that is that that's a complete waste of money. When you spend 40% of the entire planet's military budget, you're responsible for 40% of it, and you lose to goat herds with fertilizer. That's a racket. That's nothing to do with, you know, absolving New Zealand of the need for its own defense. Because if you think the United States military, which isn't even, that isn't even the spending that's just going bananas. So Charles was wrong there. You know, what's sending the spending? I mean, right now, again, as I said in After America, I predicted this would happen. The interest on the debt would be more. The interest on the debt is more than the entire Pentagon budget. And it's not being spent on. And nobody's saying, oh, you know, I was driving in California the other day, and I came to this thing. Have you seen it? The Golden Gate Bridge? My word, you should see that. It's good to know where some of this government... and then I came to this big... what's it called? The big humongous dam, the Hoover Dam. Wow, that's spectacular. You can't show anything that the money... The money's just been blown. There's nothing to show for it. You can't... It's not like... And we all know people like that. You know, you know people who spend money, but they've got a house or they've invested in a new business. There's nothing to show for where the money has just been blown. And so and the fact that you could get away with it at 10 trillion means that this is how Washington thinks. They think, oh, yes, yeah, so if we can get away with it, 10 trillion, what's the big deal? Because now here's what the responsible people say. Every time we have this, again, this is part of the degeneration of Democratic politics into dinner theatre. So we have this particularly stupid thing where you have the debt showdown every year or two. Oh, the Republicans are threatening to shut down Congress over an increase in the debt ceiling. And that would mean that America would default, and then we would look to the world as if we weren't serious. Serious about what? Serious about just ramping up the $35 trillion debt to $40 trillion, $50 trillion, $75 trillion? This at some point, as I said, some point gravity will assert itself. Joel in the failed state of California says, ahoy there, matey. Oh, I like that. Ahoy there. That's what Alexander Graham Bell wanted people to say on the telephone. Ahoy. Ahoy. And then Thomas Edison came along and said, no. I think it would be better if it was hello. Joel says, did Bill Maguire's comment on wishing a pandemic to massively kill off billions of humans for the sake of climate control intend to include among the victims a fraudulent science poser who shops at Wegmans? That's a reference to Michael Mann's famous claim of emotional trauma because someone looked at him askance in aisle 9 at Wegmans. Joel continues, if not, will the guy who perceived a possibly mean glance at the grocery store so terrible that it warrants third-party stealing of $1 million from someone also include an acknowledgement in his next paper that he appreciates being left out of the global death wish by his British scientific colleague? What would Maguire make of such acknowledgements, given the seeming frivolousness of his gratitude so clearly stated in your trial? This Bill Maguire guy, every so often these guys give the game away. and they say, yeah, we need to cull. I think that was the word that Bill Maguire used. We need to cull billions of human beings from the planet. Yeah, that's what they want to do. They have these conferences and things where they, who's the woman who says the ideal population for the planet is about half a billion people. So there's, 7.5 billion who've got to go somewhere. Something's got to be done about them. And again, the thing about it is, and there's people who think that half billion is too high. In fact, there's people who, there's a guy who published a very successful book called A World Without Us, that really the ideal state of the planet is without humanity. Again, I wrote about all this in America Alone, which is almost 2 decades ago now. There's a little sort of thing in the beginning of it where I'm talking about, how are we going to decide, who it is who gets to survive? So, Michael E. Mann appears to have the hots for, it wouldn't just be the unprepossessing climate scientists like Bill Maguire and Michael E. Mann. You'd have to have the members of the celebrity class. Michael E. Mann's always going on about his bromance with Leonardo DiCaprio. And then maybe Bill Maguire likes, Scarlett Johansson. I think in America Alone, there's a little bit about Scarlett Johansson paddling through the ruined planet in a dugout canoe while she's wearing a fur bikini or something. So there'll be Michael Mann and Leonardo DiCaprio. They make a lovely couple. Bill Maguire and Scarlett Johansson. But there won't be you. There won't be Joel in the failed state of California. He'll be one of the ones that the planet doesn't need. They've got it all worked out. You listen to Bill Gates that gave a TED talk the other day. He's talking about $2 vaccines. Well, what's the vaccine for? Oh, doesn't matter. They're vaccines for everything. There's going to be vaccines that will vaccinate you against everything, and there'll be $2, and it'll all be from Gates R Us outlets, which will be all over the planet. And he's saying, we can do this. COVID-19 is going to be the last pandemic. Because once you shoot the Gates juice into your arm, then we'll have eliminated influenza. Not just coronaviruses, but influenza. This is the way these guys talk. Gone Birding, possibly not his or her real name, says, just saw confirmation that my auto renewal went through and I'm in the club for another happy year. Great to have you back, Gone Birding, for another 12 months. This membership is still the best deal in town. I love all the available categories, music, reviews, stories and poems, and all the offered commentary. Laura's Links is especially dear to me. Do you think it might be possible to expand Tales for Our Time to include the occasional essay? There are two that I think would be especially fine: Winston Churchill's Painting as a Pastime and Orwell's Some Thoughts on the Common Toad. Well, we have done non-fiction. We did Sitwell's Journey Through the Book of Vina when the Ukraine war started, because it's an excellent guide to what that part of the world was like in the 1930s. It changed somewhat in the ensuing years. And in fact, I was going to do an essay from Orwell as the sort of warm-up, as a curtain raiser to a serialization we were thinking about. But it wasn't the Some Thoughts on the Common Toad. It was a cracking essay by Orwell, and I thought people would like it, but we put that on hold. But I will take that under consideration, Gone Birding, and glad you're with us for another year. Absolutely delightful. Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A across the planet. You want music? Tough. We've moved all the tunes to Saturdays on 7-8 Radio, 5 p.m. London time, which is 6 p.m. in Western Europe, 6 p.m. as far as Slovakia. in fact, where the Prime Minister is fighting for his life. In North America, it's 12 midday Eastern on Saturday. I hope you'll join me this weekend. People seemed to like our first two shows, and I think they'll like this one. But that's going to do it for today. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. Our current tale for our time, which we were talking about just now with Gone Birding. The Secret Adversary by Agatha Christie continues tonight and wraps up on Friday. Don't miss it. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Stein Club, come on in. The water's fine. And don't forget, for the Stein Shy chum in your life, there's a Mark Stein Club gift membership with his or her name on it. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay out of court.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.